You're too damn white, guys.
All right, welcome back to another Too Damn White Guys. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Ritter.
And we're here today with psychologist, evolutionary psychologist, Jeffrey Miller. Jeffrey, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You have your bachelor's from Columbia University in biology and psychology, and you've received your PhD in cognitive psychology from Stanford in 1993, and you've written a bunch of books, and you're just an all-around pretty smart guy when it comes to evolution and psychology. So we're going to cover a bunch of different stuff today, which should be pretty fun.
How many books is it? It was at least half a dozen or something like that. And I think I read that you had 150 papers or something like that.
I've got about 110 academic publications of various sorts. Mm-hmm. I've only really done like three sort of popular books. I did one called The Mating Mind about 20 years ago, then one called Spent that was about consumer behavior about 10 years ago. And then a sort of dating advice book called Mate with Tucker Max about 3 years ago.
We've been kicking around a bunch of different topics that we want to cover today. Hopefully we'll have time to get to all of them. But, you know, we'll just dive in and see what happens. We'll see where we can get in about 40 minutes. Andrew, is there a specific place you wanted to start?
Well, Jeff, I think that I was watching one of your interviews and you were talking about how the whole field was pretty much created, evolutionary psychology. It's sort of in between biology and psychology, and it's using evolution to look at how human behavior actually works. And for a long time, people are trying to avoid that and trying to separate them, like anthropology going off in its own direction and trying to put up a wall, build up a wall between biology and how humans actually function. But, you know, we're part of nature. And I guess also there's a lot of controversy in your field, or at least you get a lot of pushback now with political correctness and social media and saying things. So it's kind of like a dangerous academic field to pursue to some extent. So I don't know if you can talk about some of your experiences with that. That might be a good place to start. But just talking about how like the humans work in a context of evolution in particular, like sexual selection.
Yeah, I think evolutionary psychology was kind of like the intellectual dark web before the IDW got a name. I mean, it's only been around 30 years or so. Like when I was a grad student at Stanford, the field was kind of being invented in front of my eyes by its leading intellectuals, Lee DeCosmides and John Tooby. And they tried to stitch together archaeology and anthropology and primate behavior, animal behavior, cognitive science, and kind of make this new way of understanding human nature. That was their goal. And somehow it became really controversial to actually treat humans as biological organisms that evolved, mm-hmm. and not just from the neck down, but also from the neck up in a way that affects our beliefs and preferences and desires and sex differences and individual differences. So it's always been controversial.
People don't want to be mammals. They don't want to be animals for some reason.
People don't want to be animals or mammals or primates or anything. And that's sad because I think, to me, my quality of life is a lot better for understanding my animal nature and human nature.
Yeah. I think they call that cognitive dissonance, right? When people are behaving in one way and it's actually the other way.
Yeah. And also you get spoon-fed a lot of nonsense, you know, ideological nonsense from the powers that be. And I think having an evolutionary psychology insight into who we are and what we really want is a great defense against being kind of manipulated and exploited.
What kind of pushback have you had? What's like one of the more notable instances where you've said something and you've met resistance or something like that?
I mean, the main problem is it's just hard to get a job. I mean, I train a lot of PhD students and I say, look, worldwide, there's about two or three evolutionary psychology jobs per year advertised versus like hundreds of jobs in social psychology or health psychology or clinical psychology or even behavior genetics. So if you want to do this field, don't count on being hired to do it. You have to have kind of other arrows in your quiver. You have to be able to sell yourself in a slightly more mainstream way.
I think you were talking about other fields in psychology where people could just banter around big words and kind of the mainstream ideas that were in vogue and kind of automatically have positions and papers and stuff like that. But you thought that was a little bit, a lot of them were kind of like BSing. So it's better to actually do experiments and figure out what's actually going on with humans. Is it experiment based a lot, or is it actually just based on like looking at human behaviors? How do you do actually research in this field?
Well, I've done like a huge range of different empirical methods, from behavior genetic studies that rely on like existing twin databases to, I had a PhD student do a dissertation on stand-up comedy, where he did like in-depth qualitative interviews with 30 professional stand-up comedians. I've had other grad students go off and work with tribal people in South America and give them intelligence tests and see how that works. I've done surveys, both in person and online, secondary analyses of existing data sets. So there's a huge range of different methods that you can use. And basically, whatever my problem is that I'm focused on, I'll try to figure out what's the kind of optimal approach given like limited time and money and energy and like who has to finish their dissertation when and so forth.
Yeah, I think one of the most controversial topics that you research is maybe sex differences. So difference between men and women and possibly like gay people and things like that as well. How it interfaces with politics and polyamory, which I think you described as one of the most disliked group of people people that are distanced from because it's fine to say you're gay or trans or whatever, but you can't really say you're polyamorous these days. I guess even still, it's not accepted because our civilization is totally based on the monogamous pair bonding, basically. Can you talk about any experiences where you've gotten pushback over that or just researching it? And I mean, I don't know you personally, is that like, is that something you do or what?
Yeah, I do polyamory. I'm out as polyamorous, and I've done that for about 4 or 5 years with my primary partner, Diana Fleischman. And we've talked about that a number of times on different podcasts and interviews.
Did you guys become poly evidence, together?
She kind of turned me.
Really?
In a way, like, yeah, if you'd asked me 6 or 7 years ago, could I ever handle an open relationship, I would have said no way, that sounds impossible.
Yeah.
It's like old dog, new tricks, not at my age. I can't do that. And it's a really steep learning curve. It's really difficult the first couple of years, but you can actually change your mating strategy to a greater degree than you might ever think. But yeah, as Andrew pointed out, the problem is there's this huge stigma. Mm-hmm. Like the evidence says the stigma against polyamory or any kind of ethical non-monogamy is stronger than any stigma that we found as a function of like race or religion or sexual orientation or whatever. So we have a very monogamous society that doesn't really cut people much slack about, violating monogamous assumptions.
Is that because historically there was a lot of issues with polyamory, obviously, STIs are a pretty new thing. Maybe syphilis goes back to the 1500s at least. Parentage. And there's some like tribes in the Amazon and stuff like that who like intentionally mix parentage, paternity basically. So they're kind of like everyone's the father kind of thing because they have these polyamorous practices, right? So I guess that's why there's a stigma. Would you say that is why evolutionarily there's maybe a stigma, because it possibly, and it's just like a tribal thing and create social divisions within a tribe if there's these disputes over paternity and things like that?
I think there's two big things going on. One big thing going on is that every major, large-scale, successful civilization in history, whether it's the Han Chinese or Western Europe or India or whatever, has been normatively monogamous. Like everyone's kind of expected to do a monogamous pair bond. There's little exceptions around the edges. There's always a little bit of sex work. There's always a little polygyny, where the top males have kind of courtesans or secondary wives. But every big civilization that works is normatively monogamous. And I don't think that's an accident. I think monogamy is a really good way for civilization to get buy-in from all of the males, right? To be able to offer to every male, you have a chance of finding a wife, because we're restricting all the other guys to having just one wife. So that's a really powerful way to get a civilization to be formidable and to get everybody kind of on board with the economy and the technology and the culture. However, that doesn't mean that's still the optimal way to do it. So like on the one hand, I have huge respect for monogamy as a way that a civilization can be strong. On the other hand, as a libertarian who thinks people should have kind of maximum freedom generally, I don't think monogamy is necessarily the right way forward for the 21st century for some people.
Yeah, I think maybe it's also kind of got a stigma because it seems, I don't personally think this, but I feel like as opposed to, you know, coming out as gay or something like that, there is a stigma around polyamory where it feels like, I feel like people think that people have a choice or something, like they have a say in the matter. Like, you know, it's like, oh, I've decided I want to be polyamorous now. Whereas like, I would say it's probably more likely, and I don't really know, so I'm kind of asking, but it seems like it would be kind of in us genetically, in all of us somewhere, because I mean, I know that a lot of societies have been polyamorous and that actually very few successful societies have been monogamous when you compare the two.
Yeah, like the number of societies that are monogamous is small, but the vast majority of humans who have lived in the last 10,000 years have been in monogamous societies.
Right.
Because they tend
or
to
at least ostensibly, right? Because any monogamous society, you have a lot of cheating going on. It's the same thing you see with like pair-bonded birds. There's so,
so
much
what's the
incentive
difference?
To cheat, right?
Yeah, exactly. So to me, the key thing about polyamory is freedom and choice and ethics and openness, right? That it's an ethical way to relate to people more than having kind of a like a normatively monogamous system, but with a lot of kind of cheating on the side. I really don't think that that is sustainable because like in an era of social media and smartphones where you can monitor your partner's behavior all the time, it seems completely ludicrous to try to do a sort of unethical monogamy. It's just too easy to get caught. It's crazy. Like there's GPS, there's, you know, tracking apps. That is insane. I think basically people are either going to have to choose to be absolutely strictly like Mormon level monogamous, or they're going to have to do some kind of practical ethical polyamory.
Yeah. Well, even just aside from being caught, like if you, you know, if you're going to be in, if you're going to commit to something like monogamy, you shouldn't have a double standard for it. You shouldn't, you know, make exceptions around it and sneak around like, you know, just on ethics alone.
Yeah. And I don't think you can have a sexual double standard either. And this is where I part ways from a lot of the guys in the manosphere and the red pill and pickup artists is they seem to think, well, women should all be monogamous and men shouldn't. And it's like, do the math. That doesn't work. Yeah. That makes no sense.
I think there's a cliche where evolutionary scientists get asked, what's the evolutionary basis for something? So what do you think the evolutionary basis for monogamy is?
I mean, the basis for monogamy is that we like, I believe in pair bonds. We've been forming pair bonds where one man and one woman get together and fall in love and they have babies and they raise the babies together and they tend to have a long-term relationship. Humans have been doing that for at least 2, maybe 3 million years. I think that's totally legit. That's a good default. I think it works really well. But the monogamous norm is a little different. It's like taking the pair bond and supercharging it, right? With like religion and rituals and weddings and expectations about exclusivity and, you know, telling people your whole desire for sexual variety and novelty is now illegitimate. So it's kind of like taking the pair bond and ritualizing it to kind of an absurd degree. And that's what I think the problem is. Like I'm totally happy to be in a pair bond with Diana and for that to be the most important relationship.
It also seems like maybe it's partly like influenced by, I mean, you were just saying how for the last 10,000 years, monogamy kind of has been, you know, the most common in the bigger societies, the most successful ones. And it almost seems kind of in line with the idea of society in general, the idea that, you know, you're going to have more successful child rearing experience inside civilization with a partner than you will if you're just a forager running around, sleeping around with whoever's out there with you.
Yeah, pair bonds are great for raising kids. They're great for like keeping life relatively simple, because once you form a pair bond, and if it is fairly exclusive, you can take all this energy and time, right, that you had devoted to mating effort, to finding a mate and courting them. You can devote that to parenting and doing like economically productive stuff and contributing to your civilization. So it kind of is a huge time saver potentially.
Yeah, dating's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's like, it's as much work and energy as creativity and creativity as anything gets, yeah. Right? Because you're competing with everybody else in the mating market.
It almost seems like, I mean, I wouldn't know from personal experience, but just my friends who are using all these dating apps and stuff, like it almost seems like more work now because there's so many options. And it's like, you know, all my friends who are using these dating apps are like, oh, I don't like anybody when I meet them because I read everything about them on my phone before I meet them. And then they don't live up to the expectation because I've got this idea of them in my head already. And it's almost like creating more work.
Yeah, it's a kind of a curse to be able to Google anybody before you meet them. and so the dating apps that provide that, I used to love OkCupid because you could answer like thousands of questions about like every aspect of what you wanted and what your politics were and what your interests are. And then if you're a high match level to somebody on OkCupid, you could be like, I know this will be an interesting dinner, even if there's no chemistry, because we are so highly matched.
Or maybe it's better if they're different, then you have more to talk about.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a very high match to anybody because I'm pretty weird. But if you don't have that, if it's just like Tinder plus Google somebody, then you meet and you're not nearly as impressive as your LinkedIn profile. Yeah, that's sad. In the future, right, there will be dating apps that are kind of better integrated with real life and that hopefully give people more realistic expectations.
Yeah.
I know one of your interests is sex differences and politics. Is there any spillover from polyamory into that, or is that strictly looking at differences between genders and maybe also sexual orientations and things like that, and how politics, I guess how they influence politics more than how politics influences them?
There's a lot of complicated interactions between, you know, sex differences and sexual politics and a lot of current debates about like trans rights and Me Too and the wage gap, the alleged wage gap. And what I think we see in society is a lot of tension between men and women kind of being expressed at the political level and kind of avoided at the personal level in a weird way.
I noticed that you said alleged.
Alleged wage gap in the sense that, like, if you control for things that are relevant, there's not actually a wage gap that's based on discrimination. Stereotyping. That's kind of a fiction of the left.
That's an interesting view. I mean, I don't know. I don't have enough data to make a judgment one way or the other, but I think that's a pretty controversial viewpoint that you would get a lot of pushback about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Christina Hoff Sommers is pretty good on this topic. And, you know, she does her factual feminist YouTube rants about it. From my kind of libertarian perspective, it just would not make sense at all for a business to sort of fail to employ qualified women and pay them and be able to pay them less. Like the free market would take care of that.
Yeah, I don't know, unless there's maybe unconscious biases in our society that cause people to have different outcomes, even given their... like not everything's rational, right? Like I agree in a completely fair marketplace, but there's no such thing as that. That has never really existed. So I think that it's definitely possible for there to be, like the stock market is not fully rational. It doesn't take account of all information. Theoretically, every stock would be equal, like evenly priced to its price earnings ratio and its inherent value, but that's just completely false, right? Because there are a lot of human biases and humans are imperfect and things like that. So there could be, I think there could be definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Like around the margins, people are a little bit irrational about a lot of aspects of, you know, trading and finance and investments. But if there was a huge wage gap where qualified women who are as committed to their career are being paid substantially less than qualified men, there's a massive arbitrage opportunity there for any innovative company, right, to undercut its competitors by this alleged 20 or 30% just by hiring those women.
Well, maybe that's happening a little bit, right, with some of the newer companies in Silicon Valley and other places that are really, you know, equal and taking account of that and really hiring a lot of women. Maybe they're actually taking advantage of that arbitrage opportunity right now.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, the other weird thing about the wage gap is the claim that it hasn't really shifted in its magnitude for decades. Like, how is that even possible, that it's been like 70 or 80 cents on the dollar for decades without any change whatsoever, despite, you know, women now being the majority of college grads, the majority of grad students, you know, having much stronger representation politically and in the C-level corporate suites. Mm-hmm. Like that, sure, that also makes no sense.
It also probably depends on what data you use, because, you know, out of the Fortune 500 companies, I think 23 CEOs are women. So, and obviously CEOs pay is like skewed massively, massively. So if you're just taking averages throughout the whole data set, you get definitely, although I guess that's not equal pay for equal work. So, because you would be comparing CEOs to CEOs, right? So I don't know. It's that's a tough one. I don't know about that one. That's a pretty controversial one too. Yeah.
Where I do agree with, you know, the feminists about this issue is I think corporate life in general has to become much more pronatalist and family friendly. Academia needs to become much more family friendly. I think you need to be able to have an awesome career and be a dedicated parent without having the kind of trade-offs that people face right now.
Mm-hmm.
And
I agree.
You know, in academia, it's absolutely brutal that the age at which women are expected to get tenure is exactly the same as the age of kind of peak motherhood.
Yeah.
Like that's insane.
Well, that's a huge effect too, because they'll lose career opportunities and things like that. And actually, that's another reason why, you know, the market will sort it out may not be the answer, because women do, you know, take diversions to have families and stuff like that, which, you know, is good. It's healthy for society as well. But obviously, that means possibly missed opportunities. So that means that they're not as competitive from a strictly, you know, workplace calculus, right? So the arbitrage opportunity may not be there, because there are reasons, you know, there are reasons based on choices that they have to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to play devil's advocate against myself here, one of my favorite economists is actually kind of lefty. It's Cornell economist Robert Frank, who takes a really evolutionary viewpoint on work and labor and free markets and so forth. And he points out that there's some serious coordination problems. Like, for example, a lot of Americans would love to have 6 weeks paid holiday like Germany has, but it's really hard to kind of get everyone together to agree to that. And if we could agree to that, people would love it. Because then if you're a parent, you don't have to worry about every little day you take off if your kid gets sick and has to stay home from school.
But it's a trade-off.
Yeah.
Right. Like everything's a trade-off, and it's not clear. I mean, I think there is lower productivity in Europe for that reason. And maybe it's a positive overall, but it is a trade-off, right? And that you definitely lose productivity. I mean, especially in places like France and stuff, although they have a lot of strikes. And so, you know, it's really hard to fire people. So, and they all, France has lost, like, I don't know, they lose like a month or two every year to lost labor and striking and things like that. So, yeah, it's tough.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. I heard this statistic the other day. I was talking to somebody about this this pay gap between men and women, and they were saying something about how women on average in America anyways make like, or men make 1.5 times more than women for the same work. Where do... Do either of you guys know where stats like this come from and if they have any validity to them? Because I feel like it's like you said, Andrew, the marketplace is not really fair exactly. Things sell for what they can be sold for, and whatever people can get away with paying or selling something for, that's what it's worth at the time. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there is or isn't a pay gap. But what do you just said, Jeffrey, that you don't think there is a pay gap. So can you kind of explain that a little bit?
Well, the economists and policy wonks I respect the most say, if you control for the relevant stuff that actually predicts productivity, like education and hours worked per week and, you know, vacation time taken and maternity or paternity leave taken, if you take all that into account, then the pay gap sort of vanishes to near zero in most industries. Having said that, there's certainly a lot of industries that involve very high levels of physical risk, like logging or underwater welding or, you know, working on an oil rig or stuff like that, where women aren't as willing to take those risks. So then the question arises, might there be economical ways to kind of re-engineer those occupations so that the risk was lower and women would be more willing to do them? And a lot of those jobs are pretty high paying.
Yeah, there's a recurring theme here. People don't want to be animals and they don't want to be different. People don't want to think they're different from each other. But you know, there's got to be a way to say that we are all different without saying that that means that that makes some of us worse than others or something like that. It's comparative advantage between people.
Yeah, and the individual differences often swamp the sex differences, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of jobs that are insanely risky that I wouldn't want to do just because my risk tolerance is too low. Like I wouldn't, like guns are awesome, but I would not want to be a mercenary.
Is that an actual job that you can get?
That should be on a t-shirt.
Because I think the riskiest actual job is a fisherman, right? Like Alaskan fisherman or something. Forestry is pretty high. Military's not that high, actually.
Tree logging is one of the most dangerous professions, apparently.
I once calculated that you're more likely to be killed in a road accident than like as part of the military, you know, just if you take the number of people in it and then the number of deaths and stuff. So risks, that's another one of your interests, taking risks and what, from an evolutionary perspective, could entice people to actually take risks or be altruistic, which means, you know, putting other people ahead of yourself from an evolutionary perspective, like, because, you know, as Dawkins says, the purpose of existence is basically like the selfish gene. So the gene uses us for its own means to perpetuate itself. And to me, it sounds like the males are taking risks. So maybe it's kind of like a tribal show off thing to get the girls. That might be one reason. And that's sort of a sexual selection. Women like guys who take risks, basically, right? And ride motorcycles and have tattoos and stuff. Is that the reason why people would take risks, or is there other reasons why people take existential risks from an evolutionary perspective?
Yeah, I think a lot of the sex differences in risk-taking come out of the kind of sexual selection and courtship and showing off thing. But the crucial thing is it's not the risk-taking itself that's sexy, right? If you go on a date and a guy brings out a revolver and he starts playing Russian roulette, like that is not
sexy. This guy's risky. I kind of like it.
Because there's no reliable indicator of skill or competence. Yeah. So I think what women really love to see is guys
competent risk taking,
demonstrating their competence in a way where if you weren't really competent, you would just die.
So they don't like gambling except poker.
Yeah, gambling isn't actually that attractive. We're taking stupid risks if you're in the military, where it's just kind of a toss-up whether you live or die. That's not sexy. But heroic risk-taking, where like your chance of survival depends heavily on your competence, that's attractive.
Or maybe there's also, like, if you're in the military and you would go out and, you know, run out into no man's land and drag your companions, is there some benefit to that maybe because you're showing people you're willing to be part of the community and, you know, really put yourself out there for the sake of the community? By like helping your fellow man and bring him back, there may be some argument there that people who demonstrate their commitment to the tribe, there's some advantage to that because there'd be better partners, right? If they're willing to sacrifice themselves a little bit for the good of the community, which is the micro community, the family in that case. they would appear to be better partners.
Yeah, absolutely. So the argument about the evolution of human morality that I made back in my book, The Mating Mind, said, like, imagine two different tribes. In one tribe, like, it's sexually attractive and you get status for taking stupid risks that don't help anybody, like doing the Russian roulette. Tribe B, though, you take risks, but they could actually help people. Like, you drag your companion back to safety during warfare. Well, Group B is going to outcompete Group A, because if you make, like, risk-taking that is helpful, sexually attractive, then you get a huge win at the kind of tribal level. And I think that that is kind of the story of human morality, that you get, like, this confluence between what's good for the group and what's sexually attractive. And that kind of turbocharges all of our virtues.
Isn't that a controversial idea? Because biologists always say that evolution doesn't happen at the group level. It only happens at the individual level, which is definitely true, right? So the idea that a group would benefit from some activity of an individual doesn't necessarily mean that those... Because someone who's cheating within the group and not performing those activities of self-sacrifice is more likely to pass on their own genes. So the group that you describe who are self-sacrificing, they're going to have some members who are have more benefit because they're not doing that. They're just, like, holding back. And eventually the whole group's going to be composed of those individuals.
Right. That's true if you ignore the sexual selection angle, which is crucial. Mm. If you have the mate choice saying, like, you failed to help the group and therefore you are a morally disgusting loser and I won't mate with you. That's what makes the whole system work. So I agree. Mostly group selection, as people usually talk about it, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But if you stick in a little bit of sexual selection and mate choice, then you can suddenly get a lot of pro-social behavior, as long as it's attractive.
Is the sexual selection, I'm trying to figure out what the basis for that is. Is it just that that person is a more attractive mate because self-sacrificing is associated with also being, like, a better provider? Is that why it would be? And that almost implies to some extent that it would only apply to males. Like, in what way would self-sacrificing females have a sexual advantage? Would they? Maybe not.
Well, maybe that's what motherhood is.
Yeah, they could have an advantage as well, right? Because, well, think about, like, what would be a cool, successful kind of alpha woman in a tribal society?
Well, like,
it would be the woman who, like, is really good at foraging and finding food, who's very good at helping other moms take care of their kids, who's very good at social networking and sort of sharing useful gossip and information and doing all those sort of, like, feminine virtues in a way. And that can be very attractive to guys who are like, wow, she would make a great wife and mother. And
but that's not risk-taking for the sake of community. I think maybe that's your point, and that's why males have this risk-taking tendency and women maybe don't. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Well, there's a lot of risks that aren't physical risks. Actually, I have a PhD student who did her master's degree on female risk-taking, and a lot of it was kind of social risk-taking. So, like, putting yourself out, you know, on behalf of someone who's, like, lower status and standing up for them against bullying and gossip, right? That's something where a socially brave woman could do that and actually get a good long-term reputation as a good and honest and ethical person, but where it could also fail, right? And she could be known as, like, oh, you're associating with that loser, so your status is lower. So I think a lot of the risk-taking that women do is almost, like, invisible to men and sort of under the radar, and we don't even really notice it.
So let's jump to... optimal mating systems for Mars colonies. What do we say?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I don't know what you mean by this, by the way. Optimal mating system for Mars colonies. Well, are you talking about maybe you would have a selection of traits even for better success potential on Mars?
A series of petri dishes?
As a libertarian, I would imagine you would not suggest that the government should be involved in selecting people to mate, like any kind of eugenics, obviously, or whatever. So, yeah, I'm curious what you mean by this.
So So this came out of the weirdest panel discussion I've ever been invited to. It was at a paleo conference, paleo FX conference in Austin, Texas.
You don't mean like food paleo?
Yeah, the paleo conference.
But that's total BS, right?
Well, I kind of half believe in it and half I'm a little skeptical. But at that point, like 5 years ago, I was big into paleo eating and exercise and CrossFit and all that shit. So I somehow got invited to this panel discussion. At the last minute, it turned out to be, how would you leverage your knowledge of evolution to guide long-distance space exploration, particularly Mars colonization? I thought, oh man, I don't know a whole lot about rockets, but I do know about human mating systems. So I got to talking about, well, would we have monogamy on Mars? Would it make sense to select for astronauts who were only strictly heterosexual, or maybe who were a little bit heteroflexible or bisexual? So I ended up being on this panel with a bunch of NASA like exercise physiologists, and I ended up saying, well, obviously, if you're going to do a Mars colony, you should select for polyamorous and bisexual astronauts, because that gives you the greatest flexibility.
Right, more options.
Relationships, more options. And ever since then, with SpaceX and Elon Musk and all that stuff, and Falcon Heavy, and it looks like we're actually going to do Mars, I thought, well, there are actually some serious issues here about, like, if you go to Mars and you suffer a certain level of accidents and deaths, you can't really have perfect monogamy. Like, you could start out with an equal sex ratio and everybody paired up, but there's going to be some attrition. And then what? Are you going to have like 20% involuntary celibates just because like their partner happened to die?
They cause a lot of problems on Earth, so it doesn't seem desirable.
Yeah. And so I thought, this is a discussion that might be worth having, like, before we actually get to Mars and do the colonies, is to think, yeah, what would actually work under these conditions of really high stress and, you know, adventure and decent chance of accidents, death, but also where you're selecting for extremely competent, very smart, very open-minded people, right? It's not going to be a random selection of Californians being sent to Mars. It's going to be...
Unfortunately.
It's going to be SpaceX being very, very choosy about who gets sent, right?
I can think of some Californians I'd like to send to Mars.
Yeah, and then we'll have different colonies that try different things.
Yeah, you're talking about the Expanse, and the Mormons are the people who are leading the expedition to the next to another solar system. Are they totally monogamous these days, I guess? You were talking about them as ideals of monogamy. I guess under U.S. law, they had to stop the polyamory thing or the,
Yeah, I think Mormons are about as monogamous as you can get, and not just after they're married, but they also tend to marry young, right? So they don't have this weird period of like 15 years of casual dating where they're all kind of running around.
So
they actually, you know.
Most people in our society today, I think a majority actually, would be described as serial monogamy. So, you know, they go from one relationship to another. That's why the divorce rate is so high. And presumably, and I think you said there's no data on this, but if you did have polyamory, maybe you would have lower divorce rates because people wouldn't feel that they have to leave their marriage to have adventure or whatever. Especially people who get married young, I think. I got married pretty late and I could not imagine having gotten married young. I don't think it would work. So, actually, Julian got married really young.
Yeah, I was fairly young. Not as young as most people from where I'm from, but I did get married young by modern standards.
Like mid-20s, late-20s?
Yeah, like 23.
Yeah, that's super young. That's I think the average now is like 26 for women, 28 for men, something like that in America.
Yep, didn't plan to meet her when I did.
But the funny thing is we don't really have a monogamous mating system. We have this ungodly hybrid of casual dating plus serial monogamy and cohabitation and boyfriends, girlfriends, you know, getting together, splitting up, and then eventually getting married. But then you know, a 30 or 40% divorce rate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So nobody really has a very clear idea what the optimal mating system should be. It's just, we know there's a lot of heartbreak out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally.
It's tough because I really think monogamy is great. And I think it does, like you said, Jeffrey, it is, it incentivizes a lot of good things. And it is almost like it's probably the ideal to strive for, but it's definitely like not for everybody. That's my opinion. I don't think it's for everybody. And I don't think everybody's going to find one person that they'd like to spend their entire damn life with. And I think that's okay. But I think that it probably is some kind of ideal to aspire for, but that shouldn't mean that it's so exclusive.
I think this is where the individual differences come into play. Like, I think there's a lot of humans who are kind of really happy with monogamy if they can find a good mate, and they really don't want a bunch of extra complication. And then I think there's other people like me who are kind of more into novelty and variety. And I think I'm just kind of wired that way, as are many women and many, many other men. Mm-hmm. So I think... you know, monogamy can be an ethical ideal, but I think good polyamory is also an equally valid ethical ideal if you do it right.
Yeah, Jillian, yeah. You're putting this value judgment on it. And I wonder if there's something intrinsic about that. I mean, obviously, it definitely comes about in our culture, but I don't know that culture is, obviously, it's impacted by our genetics, but I don't know that if there's something even kind of intrinsic. Like, I think Richard Dawkins thinks that there's like a religious gene that basically causes us to fundamentally have this desire to believe in a higher power. And to some extent, maybe, and religion is one of the things that people get really, you know, emotional about. And I think there is almost this intrinsic, almost, yeah, like a fear, if you are atheist or something like that, this kind of like pit in your stomach that kind of says, oh, well, this is unnatural in some way, to some extent. And I think that might be the same thing with monogamy. Like, there's some, I don't know if it's based in evolution and our genetics or just our culture, but it does seem like there's something pretty fundamental that screams out monogamy is right. And I don't think that's true, though. I think it's just based on this. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it. Maybe you can help, Jeff. But there's no real reason why it should be that way. It just kind of feels that way to most people.
I mean, this is where our sort of moral intuitions get quite unreliable and fraught sometimes. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that would have seemed morally obvious and desirable 100 years ago are now seen as pretty illegitimate. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of hard to predict which way things are going to go. Like, we used to think slavery was okay, now not so much. Is monogamy going to be seen as something more like slavery, where it's like, yeah, that was the historical norm for a long time, and it sort of made sense, we thought, and seemed natural then, but now we've moved past it. Or is monogamy going to end up being more like democracy, where it's like, well, it's not perfect, but it seems like the best of the available options, right?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like property ownership, monogamy.
Yeah, people say that, but it's also just the pair bonding thing. Like, birds have it. Most birds are monogamous, although they
cheat. Yeah, but birds probably don't get jealous.
They will kill each other. Yeah, definitely they do. All animals get jealous. That's why like bulls have antlers, have antlers. Definitely they get jealous. Males kill each other all the time. Competing for mates, absolutely.
But I think it's one thing if you find one person that you want to spend the rest of your life with and both people are in it for the same reasons. It's another thing if one of those people is operating over some sense of ownership and like jealousy is fueling the whole thing. And it's like, I just want to dominate this relationship. I want you to be mine. And if I can't have you be mine all the time, it's like, it's not unconditional love is, I guess, what's the problem. It's like people say they have unconditional love for each other, but that love is actually not unconditional if there is a condition that the relationship is only valid as long as you're sleeping with each other exclusively. So it's not really unconditional love.
Yeah. And this is one of the hardest parts of the poly learning curve, is trying to figure out how do you support someone else's sexual freedom and sexual sovereignty without that sense of jealousy and possessiveness. or how do you live mastering your own jealousy instead of being beholden to it, right? A lot of guys I know who fancy themselves alpha males and think like they're a big deal in the manosphere or whatever, are absolute submissives when it comes to their own jealousy. Like they literally can't imagine ever mastering their jealousy the way that they master their aggressiveness or their irritability or lots of other emotions that are very strong. And that strikes me as very weird and kind of dysfunctional and sad, that it's like I can master every part of my life, you know, money and babies and career and my Twitter follower count and whatever, but I can't master my own jealousy. What kind of man does that make you?
A jealous man, I guess.
A jealous man, yeah. And someone who's so threatened by the thought of your, you know, your pair-bonded female partner, like actually being attracted to some other guy, that you freak out and make that the center of your life, trying to avoid that sensation.
Yeah, I guess it's because monogamy seems safe, and it's a place where you're kind of agreeing not to compete with other, your partner, I mean, well, that too, but, you know, just compete out in the world or something like that. So it opens another avenue of, oh, now I got to worry about this too, kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also tricky.
Dating's a lot of work, so.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not something you have to worry about if you choose monogamy, I guess. Yeah.
I think it's also tricky because marriage is economical. So like your partner, if you're married to them, and you're sleeping around, maybe it's like, you know, there's this gray area between sex and marriage where marriage becomes like an institution that's for like survival and stuff like that. So it's like, if you're sleeping around, maybe it's a threat to that person because their survival is in jeopardy.
Well, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, there is obviously the risk that you might prefer the other person, right? Of course, the thing is that risk exists anyway, right? So
right.
I guess that's how you have to wrap your mind around it is, you know, maybe it's actually more likely to end a marriage if you aren't able to explore other avenues because you're, you know, the desire for something is often more powerful than actually having it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're constantly pining after someone else or whatever, then maybe that's more of a threat than actually being able to act on it a little bit in some level.
Yeah, the poly couples I know who've lasted a long time have been through again and again the situation where like the partner temporarily develops an infatuation with someone else, right? And you learn, oh, that is a survivable scenario. Mm. Like we can get through that. That isn't the end of the world. We don't have to catastrophize about that. We don't have to divorce. Whereas the monogamous couples, you know, if one of them starts to fall for someone else, they will tend to catastrophize and like, how dare you? How could you? This is such a betrayal. Mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. it becomes the worst thing that could ever possibly happen.
Oh, the other thing is if a marriage is not really functional anyway, and it's having these problems, maybe it deserves to die, right? And it's better off if people move on. I think Fran Lebowitz said that she had like multiple marriages and she said everyone was a success or something like that.
Right? Yeah, I think that's like, probably true.
You know, I think that if a marriage fails as a result of one of these kinds of things, maybe it's for the best anyway, right? I don't know.
I think the crucial thing is, like I'm very pronatalist, I'm very pro-family. I think babies are great. I think whatever is good for parents getting along so that they can help raise kids long-term is kind of on balance good. But a monogamous mating system is not necessarily very anti-fragile about that, right? Because when people divorce, they tend to like move long distances apart and they don't necessarily have shared custody. And so what I would ideally want is a kind of monogamish or poly system where like providing a stable family context for raising kids is sort of the main priority. And I don't think the current monogamous system does a very good job of that.
Well, this is interesting stuff. I feel like we should probably wrap this up because we're getting close to an hour here. This has been a lot. Is there anything anybody else wants to say before we tie it up?
Oh, yeah. The main thing that people are going to take away from this is like, oh, Miller's advocating polygyny. And I think it's really important to distinguish polyamory from polygyny.
Oh, yeah, right. You're advocating totally choice, too.
Totally the different.
The other thing is, if you like monogamy, stick with monogamy. If you don't, people should have the freedom to not. I think that's what you're advocating. Right.
Yeah, polygyny is patriarchy. Polyamory is not patriarchy.
Yeah.
People always talk about how monogamy is like this institution of ownership. And I'm sure there's definitely something to that, like marriage being like an ownership and property based and stuff like that. And it certainly is in some sense. But if you look at the equation, it's almost like monogamy is a pact between men in a sense, because if you have like totally free, you know, polyamory and also polygyny, polygamy, which means, you know, both men and women, then like the best guys get the best girls. And if they can have like multiple, it all lines up so that the guys at the bottom get nothing, basically. So the real losers in a total free-for-all polygamy system are actually the men at the bottom, not women in any sense at all, right? So
polygyny, the top males like monopolize the women.
And the women get good matches because they're, you know, they basically match up, and the men at the bottom don't get good matches because they're just excluded entirely. And so it was suggested, I think, that monogamy and marriage was basically a pact between men, like not a, you know, a tacit pact between men, basically not agreed upon, that prevented warfare, basically, because otherwise there's all these disgruntled men who don't have mates, which is kind of what you see in China these days with one child policy where they elected to have boys. In India, you have selection in favor of boys, like a lot of women babies were killed, girl babies were killed and stuff like that, or aborted, basically. So you have higher proportions of men in society. So there's all this disgruntled males who will never have any success in mating. And that just creates a lot of social strife and potentially warfare.
Yeah. Maybe instead of exchanging wedding rings, we should give rings to all of our male friends just to remind them that we're married.
and the whole thing with the incel thing too, which is like the social phenomenon in the West now, it's not necessarily that, there's a disproportionate amount of males, but it's that women these days, there's a lot more freedom to not get married, and a lot of women choose not to, right? So there's just excluding themselves from the pool in some sense. And then there's these men who don't have mates and cause a lot of problems.
Yeah. So like if I was running China and I was worried about tens of millions of young men who can't find a girlfriend, I think actually polyamory would offer more flexibility in the whole system. Because it means the men aren't trying to dominate like the one girlfriend. The girlfriend can actually have multiple male partners. Mm. And that means you can actually like soak up a lot of this excess male energy.
Sex robots.
Well, yeah, you could also have sex robots. You could also have VR porn. There's lots of other options. But I think in terms of having real people interacting, you just can't have a monogamous system that has a massive excess of single males. That is not going to be a happy system.
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. This has been Two Damn White Guys with Jeffrey Miller on a bunch of things. Thank you for listening. And if you want to follow us, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here on Twitter. Andrew's at Mars Raider. And Jeffrey is at Primal Poly. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you feel so inclined. Those are very helpful. And we do these every Monday, so we hope to have you back next week. Have a great week. Take care.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. That was fun.